John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, August 12, 2010. Abbas meets Mubarak over the direct talks with Israel while Israeli attacks continue in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas met with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in Cairo on Thursday to discuss the start of the direct talks between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Abbas informed Mubarak with the latest results of the meeting with the U.S. envoy to the Middle East, George Mitchell, who continues to press the Palestinians to start the direct talks. Palestinians had demanded that Israel freezes the construction of all settlements in the West Bank as a prerequisite to start direct talks, a demand that Israel continued to strongly reject. The meeting between the two leaders comes shortly after Egyptian security forces have took control of 17 tunnels Palestinians used to traffic goods from Egypt to the Gaza Strip. In other news, Israeli forces kidnapped 8 Palestinians in different locations in the West Bank. Troops kidnapped Ahmed Dola from the city of Qalqilya in the northern part of the West Bank. An Israeli undercover force chased Dola, 22, in the nearby village of Hijja and shot him. He was captured and taken by the undercover soldiers, and no information about his injury was revealed. In Betunia near Ramallah, Israeli troops raided the town and kidnapped Ahmed Al-Frouch, 32, and his brother Mahmoud. Troops blindfolded Al-Frouch and took him to an unknown destination and released his brother shortly after. In the meantime, an Israeli military force kidnapped Adil Al-Salaima, 17, from the city of Hebron. Troops patrolling the old city stopped Al-Salaima and checked his document, then blindfolded him and took him to an unknown destination, eyewitnesses reported. The other kidnapped youth were not identified as of the time of this report. In the Gaza Strip, an Israeli military force invaded Al-Farahin area east of Khan Yunis city Thursday morning. Palestinian news agency Wafa reported that 4 bulldozers backed with 5 tanks raided the area and opened fire at residential areas. However, no injuries were reported. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For constant updates, please visit our website at www.imenc.org. This report has been brought to you by George Ishmael.
Afghanistan, Wednesday. An occupation soldier was killed in an undescribed insurgent attack in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, yesterday. A crowd of about 300 villagers yelled death to the United States and blocked a main road in eastern Afghanistan as they swore that U.S. forces had killed three innocent villagers in an overnight raid. Thursday's raid happened before dawn in Wardak Province's Sayyidabad district. Elders from Zarankil village said American troops stormed into a family's house and shot three brothers, all young men, and then took their father into custody. Afghanistan, the past week. Afghan army troops tried to show their superiority over the Taliban with an offensive in Bodh Pak in Laghman province, east of Kabul. The offensive began 9 days ago and promptly bogged down into what may have been a prepared defensive position. The Afghan army began this on their own, only to end up begging U.S. and NATO forces for help when the fighting got so intense the Red Cross could not enter and the bodies of the dead could not be removed. This is still bogged down, even with the assistance of occupation troops. July next year is Obama's stated deadline for beginning to remove U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Now General Petraeus says this deadline depends on conditions, and if progress is not made, he will ask Obama to keep U.S. troops in Afghanistan longer. U.S. troops are still under fire in Iraq, and thus still in combat there despite last Sunday's ceremony supposedly transferring all combat operations to the Iraqi government. Dawana, Iraq, Wednesday. Four Katyusha rockets hit U.S. Camp Echo, according to an Army source. Quote, Camp Echo, 3 kilometers west of Dawana, came under four Katyusha rockets, but no information was obtained about casualties or losses, the anonymous source told Aswat al-Iraq News Agency. Baghdad, yesterday. A rocket landed in Baghdad's southern Dura district, killing one person and wounding three others, an Interior Ministry source reported. Mosul, Iraq, today. One Iraqi soldier was killed and two more were wounded in an insurgent attack on a checkpoint. What happened to U.S. forces ending combat operations and leaving Iraq, Mr. Barack Obama? Does the continued fighting there sound to you like a viable model for Afghanistan? Now's the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home from all these wars today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. You won't see me back there again. No, you won't see me back there again.
The 8th of August, anti-war protesters showed up at Quantico Marine Base demanding that Bradley Manning, the person accused of sending the documents to WikiLeaks that proved the U.S. is losing the Afghan war, be released, not prosecuted.
Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning!
My name is Matt. I served in Iraq in 2004. As an intel analyst, and as a former analyst, I stand with Bradley Manning today.
All right. Hey, all right.
Silence is betrayal.
That's right.
Silence is betrayal. The truth of these wars we all know, and some have seen. And Bradley Manning was courageous enough, brave enough, to stand against the military machine and release these things. Possibly. He's been accused, not convicted. If this is true, I admire his courage and strength.
Amen.
It is not criminal to tell the truth. It is not criminal to speak out against the military machine. It is criminal to stay silent in the face of something immoral, in the face of injustice. While there is injustice, there will never be peace. And it is unjust to jail someone for speaking the truth, for bringing to the American consciousness what we all know to be true. And that's these wars are immoral, they're illegal, and they're unjust. And it's time to end them. It's time to bring our troops home. It's time to bring our soldiers home. Marines, Navy, everyone, bring them back. Stand with the Afghan people. Support the Afghan people, but not militarily. It's time to end these wars. I hope that we can all recognize that Bradley Manning is a hero and that he deserves to be freed and to be heard. Let his voice be heard, not the voices of many people for or against him, but let him tell his story, why he may or may not have done what he has done. So that's all I have to say.
All right. All right. Here's
our youth. Give them power to speak the truth. Bradley Manning is our youth. Give them power to speak the truth. Bradley Manning is our youth. Give them power to speak the truth. Bradley.
Wars need secrets. Illegal wars keep illegal secrets. These aren't the only secrets. These are only secrets to people in this country. People in Afghanistan, they know this. People in Iraq, they know this. They don't need us to release documents telling them what's happening in their countries. The Taliban knows this. The people know this. The resistance forces, the anti-resistance forces. This isn't news. Ironically, the Obama administration is kind of trying to have it both ways. On the one hand, saying, there's nothing new here. Yeah, well, that's certainly true. But there's blood on their hands if they release it. Really? You want to really try and have it both ways?
Yep.
This is an illegal war. The secrets are illegal. Releasing secrets is the first step. This isn't just about Bradley Manning. This is about illegal wars with illegally held secrets. We should remember it was the Pentagon. It wasn't a whistleblower. It was the Pentagon who made their own decision about the decision to escalate in Afghanistan more than a year ago before President Obama announced it. They didn't seem to think that was inappropriate. We have a long history of whistleblowers in this country, and they have changed history. They come out of movements, and they strengthen movements. When Pentagon Papers 2.0 was released, what's known as the WikiLeaks documents, this absolutely reflected that history. It's a lie to say that we are protecting women. Keep in mind one thing. When those against our position who want to continue the war say, well, don't we have to stay to protect the women? Keep in mind one thing, that the vast majority of women who die too early in Afghanistan today don't die in a Taliban attack. They die in childbirth. Because Afghanistan is the second worst country in the world for a woman to give birth and survive. One out of every six women in Afghanistan dies in childbirth. Now, in the year 2000, when the Taliban was in control, how many women do you think died in childbirth? Exactly the same. One out of six. We have done nothing for the women of Afghanistan except make their lives worse. That's the answer to those who say we need to maintain a military occupation. We need this information not because it's new, but because it's irrefutable. Because it's exactly what the president said. It was nothing new, but it changes how we understand these wars. That's why we need whistleblowers. That's why secrets kill. Wars need secrets. Democracy needs whistleblowers. Thank you. Transparency.
Transparency is not a crime. War criminals do the crime. Transparency is not a crime. War criminals do the crime.
Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
In testimony before Congress in February, President Obama's Director of National Intelligence, Admiral Dennis Blair, declared that the president reserves the right to have the CIA carry out assassinations against U.S. citizens who are engaged in terrorist activity. His comments before the House Intelligence Committee were directed at Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen who is thought to be living in Yemen. Al-Awlaki, who was born in Las Cruces, New Mexico, is accused of being a leader in al-Qaeda, whose sermons were attended by three of the 9/11 hijackers. Fort Hood shooter Nidal Malik Hassan and the failed Christmas Day bomber Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab both say they met with and were inspired and or trained by al-Awlaki. During the first week of August, the American Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control to obtain a license which is required under federal regulations to represent anyone named as a specially designated global terrorist, which al-Awlaki was about 2 weeks after his father, Nasser, retained the ACLU and Center for Constitutional Rights to represent him in an effort to stop the government's targeted killing. The Treasury Department responded to the suit by granting the license on August 4th, clearing the way for the two groups to seek a federal court injunction preventing the Obama administration from assassinating al-Awlaki without due process of law. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jonathan Maines, a legal fellow with the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project. He explains the important precedents being established in the court challenge to the Obama administration's self-declared authority to assassinate U.S. citizens outside war zones without charge, trial, or any constitutional checks and balances.
This is another example of a situation where it appears that President Obama is entrenching and in some cases actually extending the sort of framework that was established by President Bush. So, you know, during the Bush administration, there was lots of concern, lots of outcry from many quarters about the Bush administration's claimed authority to detain people who were picked up anywhere in the world, including inside the United States, and put them in prison with charge or trial indefinitely. There's also concern about, you know, picking people up anywhere in the world and charging them and trying them in military commissions. These are all powers that are restricted to battlefield situations, circumstances where there's an actual war going on. Now, what President Obama has done is he's sort of run with this idea of the global battlefield. The idea there being that rules that are intended to govern the conduct of a war can apply anywhere in the world that the government believes a suspect might be found. So it appears, we don't know, because the government hasn't actually set out its legal theory and still hasn't set out the criteria that it uses in deciding whether a U.S. citizen can be targeted for death. But it appears that they're taking the view that they can use quintessentially warlike means and warlike rules anywhere in the world, including in places like Yemen, where the United States isn't at war. So it's hard to say why they've decided to proceed as they have, with so little transparency and with, as far as we can tell, no due process.
Jonathan, there are many people in this country believing the country should do everything possible to prevent future attacks who are probably fully on board this idea of killing Awaki in Yemen. How do you counter the idea that the Obama administration should afford any U.S. citizen, regardless of the charge or where they're living, with due process and forego this course they're on to assassinate this guy out in Yemen?
Well, you know, I think that, unfortunately, in the last several years, it's become very sort of commonplace for people to think that the only way for us to be safe is to sacrifice bedrock civil liberties and constitutional rights that have served us well for generations. Now, we think that there's no contradiction. It's entirely possible to have a robust counterterrorism effort while still remaining within limits that are set out by our Constitution and other sources of law. So what I would say to those that think there's no problem here, I just point out how remarkable the asserted power that the president is claiming is. I mean, what we're talking about here is the power to put U.S. citizens on a list, which then authorizes the military and the CIA to hunt them and kill them anywhere in the world, even thousands of miles from any war zone or battlefield. And it's doing so without revealing to anybody outside of probably a small group of people in administration what criteria have to be met before a U.S. citizen can be hunted and killed, without any sense of what the process is that's in place within the administration, and certainly without any checks outside of the administration. So the idea that the president has a unilateral authority to set up the standards that will govern when a citizen can die, and then has the authority to, be prosecutor, judge, and jury, and I suppose executioner in applying those standards, is quite remarkable. And I think that at the level of principle, most people can agree that that's not a power that we want to entrust to the unchecked executive branch. If we endorse this as a precedent, other countries may well think that, they have license to kill their suspect enemies anywhere in the world.
Jonathan Maines, your lawsuit may very well end up before the U.S. Supreme Court. Your challenge to the executive authority, the president, to assassinate a U.S. citizen without due process. What do we know about the Supreme Court's past decisions in this? We know that in the Yasser Hamdi case, by a lopsided majority, the Supreme Court actually denied that the executive branch has unchecked authority to designate somebody an enemy combatant and keep them in prison forever without charge or trial. Do you think the same opinion may hold sway in today's Supreme Court if this case came to them?
I hope so, and I think you're right. I think the Supreme Court has, on four key occasions, they've heard cases involving the president's asserted authority in the post-9/11 era, and they have come out the right way. You know, in that Hamdi opinion reference, then-Justice O'Connor said that the authorization for use of force after 9/11 was not a blank check to the president. I think it'd be difficult for a court confronted with this issue to ignore it or to simply endorse unreviewed the president's asserted authority to set the standards by which citizens will be killed and then to go out and do that anywhere in the world. So we're talking about the most fundamental right, the right to life. And the Constitution is pretty clear that no person shall be deprived of life without due process of law. So we're hoping that by bringing this issue to the courts, the program and the asserted authority will be reviewed where it should be in a judicial forum.
That was Jonathan Maines, a legal fellow with the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project. For more information on the lawsuit, call the ACLU at area code 202-457-0800 or visit the websites aclu.org or ccrjustice.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
For the past 64 years, the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, has been graduating assassins, dictators, and death squad leaders to do the dirty work of the elite in Latin America. The taxpayer-funded SOA has left a trail of violence and suffering in every country where its graduates have returned. Hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans have been tortured, raped, assassinated, disappeared, displaced, and massacred by those trained at the SOA. Enough is enough. Every year, thousands gather in Georgia to protest U.S. military involvement in Latin America. Join us at the gates of the SOA this November to honor the victims, celebrate the resistance, and pressure our government to shut down the school once and for all. From November 18th to 21st, we will have live concerts, speakers from around the world, street theater, workshops, and more. For more information on how you can stand with us to end the injustice, visit SOAW.org or call 202-234-3440.
August, protests showed up at the
Chilean embassy, demanding freedom from Mapuche indigenous political prisoners who are on a hunger strike in Chile.
A solidarity vigil to support the political prisoners in the south of Chile who are on hunger strike, and this is the 1 month anniversary, August 12th, began on July 12th. So these 31 men who are being held by the Chilean government under their so-called anti-terrorism law, they feel they are being held unfairly and they need to demonstrate and ask police and to change policy for them.
What are the Mapuche people specifically demanding?
They want that anti-terrorism law changed. Stop the implementation of the anti-terrorism law in all Mapuche cases. That was part of what happened under the Constitution with Pinochet, and they feel that it's very repressive and very harsh, and they want that lifted.
An old Pinochet-era law written with advice from the United States defines indigenous, that is to say Native American, resistance to land seizures and development as, quote, terrorism. Sound familiar?
You're saying he was shot in the back by the police in Chile?
Yes.
For what?
He was participating in an action, and the police tried to break it up.
And so they decided to rely on live ammunition. This protest is one of a worldwide sequence of simultaneous protests at Chilean embassies all over the world. This is the view from the embassy towards the street. Going double-sided. So all the yuppies going by their cars can see what this is about.
Towards the end of the vigil, protesters read out the names of the prisoners being held in Chile's dungeons.
Number 2, Luis Sergio Rangel Fidel.
Presente.
Number 3, Pablo Cano Tracal.
Presente.
Number 15, Luis Menares Canilao.
Presente.
On the 29th of July, at a Ward 1 candidates forum held by a number of D.C. progressive organizations in the True Redeemer building, D.C.'s Ward 1 council member Jim Graham showed up late, insulting the groups that put on the candidates forum by doing so. Once Jim Graham arrived, his speeches were long on blowing his own horn, but often concealed the extent of his own deal-making with developers at the expense of the people.
Question number 8. Number of homeless families in D.C. continues to grow, and families are overcrowded at the D.C. General Shelter.
Yeah, thanks to the closure of Franklin Shelter in downtown D.C.
Many other families are on a wait list for service or are living on Instagram. And what are your plans for a shelter in Ward 1 if the CASA closes? Please answer this question, please.
Thank you very much for this question.
You know, the fact of the matter is that low barrier shelters, such as at La Casa, you know, are very important, but they can't be the whole answer.
Back in 2004, Councilmember Jim Graham cast a deciding vote to close Randall Shelter so the building could be given to the Corcoran Gallery of Art. This shelter was also deemed too close to the baseball stadium. This was a 3-2 vote in committee, and Jim Graham was the undecided vote until he voted with the developers to close Randall Shelter.
Because the fact of the matter is we've got to move people into single-room occupancies, which is known as SROs. I support the mayor's efforts to do that, which is happening right now at La Casa. I support the efforts, which will also give people their own apartments, which happened to DC Village, where DC Village was an absolute nightmare until we stepped in and we said, we want you to have your own apartments. We don't want this kind of family low barrier shelter.
There's just one problem with Fenney's Housing First plan, and that is that a lot of people who were thrown out of Franklin Shelter when it closed and given an apartments promptly lost those apartments and are now back on the street.
We're still going to need low barrier shelters, and for that reason, I support the move of Central Union Mission to the Gale School at 65 Massachusetts Avenue. I worked hard to have that happen. It's finally happening. They're not going to 3512 Joyce.
And now one of Mr. Graham's primary opponents responds.
There was no space in any of the family shelters that were using DC General as a spot to house families. It should be a black letter that we're wearing on our vest, because that's the hypothermia center. So if we continue with double-digit unemployment into the winter, and we have a winter that was like last year, where do we send people who are suffering from hypothermia living physically on the streets? We have no space. So the question that I want, and I'm completely for moving people into long-term goals, trying to get them into apartments, trying to get them into home ownership, trying to create new subsidies to create more public housing. But the question I have is, all of these programs that are looking to the future, why do we close the Randolph School? Why would we close a shelter at a time that we are critically in need of bed space for families, for women, for children, for fathers, who are out actively looking for jobs every day, and they're forced to live in the hypothermia center at DC General? This is our crisis at this time, and we need to find something immediately to do that. So I would suggest that any of these schools that we have that are not being, that we need to retrofit them specifically right now for families while we have this double.
Like Franklin?
Jim Graham didn't give straight answers to somebody asking him about libraries either.
What did Mr. Graham have to say about the library situation?
Well, he pulls out the normal stuff that he's had umpteen number of meetings. But unfortunately, he never points out the fact that even his compromise was thrown off the table by DCPL and DC Public Library, and that the fact that these meetings, you can have 1,000 meetings, but if the community's voice isn't listened to, what's the point of them?
So Mr. Graham, basically, his response is, I had this meeting and I had that meeting?
Right. And he's claiming that the ramp is ADA compliant. We don't know how they changed the plans. Last, they were not ADA compliant. So somehow he has inside knowledge. And he also pointed out that the chief made some fire report claiming that this project is okay. But it's clearly going to block access off of Lamont Street, which is about access to about 1,000 people. And one of the buildings in Deauville burned dead into the ground.
Yeah, landlord arson.
Right, and the fire department couldn't get back there readily. This will make it worse. The fire department has never had a discussion with any of these surrounding neighbors in 2.5 years.
This is convenient for those who want to burn out the rest of the community up there, isn't it?
It does make it more convenient. I hate to say that. And it's sad because it's just not necessary. This is an opportunity to increase access. Instead, we're seeing a decrease for seniors and residents with disabilities, and we're seeing a decrease for the safety of the residents living around the library.
I'm giving people $100 to put yard signs in their yard.
After years of debate between giant telecommunication companies and public advocates on the need to protect free public access to the internet, qualities which make this communications platform such a hothouse for innovation and vibrant democratic discourse, the issue seems to be coming to a head. While the Federal Communications Commission dithered in taking steps to safeguard an open internet, often referred to as net neutrality, Google and Verizon were in negotiations to develop their own vision of how the internet will function in the future. In an August 9th announcement, Google and Verizon put forward a joint policy proposal that envisions two internets, one public and one private. The private internet would provide a fast lane to content for those who could afford it, with lots of bells and whistles if you pay to play. The Google-Verizon proposal would eliminate the concept of net neutrality on wireless networks, the destination most observers believe the internet as a whole is rapidly moving toward, and at the same time weaken the FCC's ability to effectively regulate the internet. The media reform group, Free Press, has for years been actively engaged in the fight for net neutrality, and along with other national organizations that are part of the Save the Internet Coalition, is urging President Obama, Congress, and the FCC to reject the Google-Verizon proposal and instead pass strong net neutrality protections. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Craig Aaron, managing director of Free Press, who examines the Google-Verizon proposal while describing the campaign now underway to defend the free and open internet.
What's so harrowing about this proposal that Google and Verizon have put together is that it really would transform and really end the open internet as we know it. You know, they paid lip service to the notion of an open internet, promising, you know, that they wouldn't mess with the internet that we have now. But what they're proposing would really transform the internet experience for a lot of people. So basically what they've done is put out this policy framework, essentially, you know, a document that they're trying to sell Congress and to a certain degree the FCC on as, you know, here's these two big companies that have gotten together, one, Google, that has historically supported net neutrality, one, Verizon, that has been one of the strongest opponents of net neutrality, and they're passing it off as a compromise. But it's really a raw deal for consumers for a couple reasons. One is they're proposing no protections for the internet when it's accessed on wireless networks. So it'd be as if you want to use your phone, and increasingly, of course, so many of us are going to be getting to the internet that way, forget it. They can block, discriminate, mess with the content however they see fit under this proposal. Another thing they would do is about this sort of private internet. They keep saying, oh, we're going to support the public internet. We were really for that. But they're opening the door essentially to push all the investment into a new fast lane. So if you sort of imagine the information superhighway, they're looking to build out their own private toll road where big companies like Verizon and Google and Comcast and all the rest, you know, would be able to ply their wares and push their content and develop their new applications. But when it comes to everybody else, you know, we get stuck back on the winding dirt road. It would be like if I told you, Scott, that, you know, hey, great, put whatever you want up on your website, but people can only get to it with dial-up speeds. So, you know, sorry if they can't stream the program, sorry if they can't listen, but you only get dial-up. I'm going to be operating in broadband. That's basically what Google and Verizon are proposing to the rest of us. Like, hey, we're going to be over here on the private internet doing our thing, and whatever you guys have now, well, hope that's good enough. So, you know, this is really not a good deal for consumers. You know, moreover, they've proposed essentially that the FCC should have no authority to make rules, that basically they could, you know, sort of answer consumer complaints, but wouldn't be in a position to set the rules of the road for everyone, which is supposed to be the FCC's job. So I think this Google-Verizon pact is really dangerous. The upside being maybe it's waking people up to the fact that net neutrality is still in danger, and despite the promises of the Obama administration and the chairman of the FCC, they still haven't delivered in terms of protecting the free and open internet.
Craig, discuss for us, if you would, the role of the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. There was a recent court decision which, in the eyes of many, handicapped the FCC's ability to regulate broadband internet services. But there has been at least some statements by the FCC chair, Julius Genachowski, that he would like to regulate broadband internet and maintain net neutrality through rules, regulations, and fines.
Yes, as you note, he said some great things. It's the the actions that have been the problem for the current FCC chairman. I mean, he got into office. He'd been a key member of the Obama campaign. Net neutrality was the top item on their technology agenda. He gave a very powerful speech almost a year ago at the Brookings Institution, laying out his vision for the open internet. An excellent speech, a great vision. It sounded like he was going to do all the right things, and he hasn't delivered on them. And you're also right that the federal court case has really complicated things. But that throws it actually back to the FCC, which has in their power, Julius Janikowski has in his power, the ability to say, you know what, we are going to reclassify broadband. We're going to regulate it the way we always did before the Bush years, and that's going to allow us to protect internet users. They started down that road. They got a lot of pushback from the powerful phone and cable lobby. They started to waver. Then they were pushed back by the public interest community and came up with what was called a third way, which was essentially a very narrow, what's called reclassification, but then they haven't delivered on that. And so instead of moving forward with these rules, what they did is they started trying to have side closed-door negotiations with the biggest phone and cable companies and the biggest content companies like Google. Those negotiations have now been called off, partly because of this Verizon-Google deal. But I think if the FCC had really stepped into the void much earlier, been much clearer about what they were going to do, we wouldn't really be in the mess we're in now. Although the irony being that that mess may actually push the FCC to take action again. So it's a strange moment, and it's complicated even further by Congress, where AT&T, Comcast, these big companies spend, you know, more on lobbying and campaign contributions than any industry except for the drug industry. They're a huge presence on Capitol Hill, and they've been able to convince dozens and dozens of members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike, to write to the FCC and say, don't do this reclassification thing. Ultimately, it's a free speech issue, and it's about whether this amazing technology that, you know, was originally developed by our government and has created so much opportunity, whether that's still going to be there or whether we're, again, just going to give it away to a small group of companies that are looking out only for their bottom line.
That was Craig Aaron, Managing Director of Free Press. Contact Free Press toll-free at 877-888-1533. Or visit their SaveTheInternet.com website.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@Hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@Hushmail.com.
Well, DNA is natural, it's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life. Each one dependent on another, and so the circle it closed up tight. But then along came a man and a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things. And now food crops grow on the ocean floor. Cows, they grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
Last winter, climate change skeptics tried to claim the blizzard as evidence against global warming. Now the hottest summer in living memory has come not only to D.C., but to many places all over the planet. Russia is plagued by heat waves, drought, and massive wildfires, making the air around Moscow almost unbreathable. Here in the D.C. area, we never used to have weather conditions so extreme. Pepco dropped the ball three, even four times in 1 year, with power outages lasting for days, even a week for some people. Now we've had a blizzard of snowstorms in the winter and a blizzard of super thunderstorms in the summer, both leading to extended power outages. Yesterday's morning storm was a typical example. It dropped 1.5 inches of rain, closed streets, dropped trees on houses, and made Rock Creek look like Great Falls. Still convinced our climate isn't changing? Still convinced All that mountaintop removal coal being burned at Pepco's suppliers of electricity isn't literally turning itself off with its own carbon dioxide-driven weather? It seems to me that we're coming to a real turning point on global climate change. Scientists have warned about this for the last decade, but with the failure of one climate conference after another, from Kyoto to Copenhagen, it just seems to me that nobody has been listening.
A longtime West Virginia politician and progressive activist is running in the Democratic primary August 28th against incumbent Governor Joe Manchin to be the party's candidate in the November 2nd special election to replace the late U.S. Senator Robert C. Byrd. Ken Heckler, who will be 96 in September, was born in New York, earned a Ph.D. in history and government from Columbia University, and held several jobs before moving to West Virginia in 1957. The following year, he won his first election to Congress and served in the House from 1959 to 1977. After leaving his House seat, he served as West Virginia's Secretary of State from 1985 to 2001. The former legislator has been a longtime foe of surface coal mining, introducing legislation to abolish it in the early 1960s. He was also principal sponsor of the 1969 Coal Mine Health and Safety Act. In 2000, he walked more than 500 miles with the late Doris Granady Haddock on her cross-country walk to promote campaign finance reform, something he believed was urgently needed due to the disproportionate contributions of coal company officials to West Virginia politicians. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus caught up with Heckler by phone as he traveled around his state calling for an end to mountaintop removal mining and seeking votes in the upcoming election.
I've always been opposed to surface mining. I think you should characterize mountaintop removal as strip mining on steroids, because it's far more devastating, particularly to the people in the valleys. And I think the only solution is abolition rather than regulation. The reason regulation will not work is because the coal industry has deep pockets and contribute millions of dollars to every member of the legislature, as well as the governor and members of the judicial branch, the Supreme Court of West Virginia.
And of course, historically and up to the present day, coal interests have contributed to members of the congressional delegation from West Virginia, both Republicans and Democrats, and to many other states, though never to you. Now, Ken Heckler, you have a long history of working on mining issues, going back to your early years in Congress in the 1960s. Tell us about some of those efforts.
Early on in my congressional career, I introduced a bill to abolish strip mining within 18 months, and I had over 100 sponsors of that bill in the House of Representatives. The problem with my abolition bill was that in the 1970s, when OPEC began to regulate and limit the amount of oil coming into this country, there was a so-called energy crisis in the United States, which caused many members of Congress to oppose my efforts to abolish strip mining. So I lost support because of the fear that many members had that we would run out of support for energy. I think today that the need to abolish mountaintop removal is even more urgent because of the fact that it is possible to mine coal through underground mining, which used to be very dangerous, but since I was able to enact the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act of 1969, there's been a dramatic reduction in fatalities. April 5th, 29 miners were killed at the Upper Big Branch mine in West Virginia. All 29 miners would be alive today if my 1969 act had been enforced, because there's a provision wrote into the 1969 act that obligates every coal mine to have a stream of fresh air no less than 9,000 cubic feet per minute. Yet that stipulation was totally ignored by the owners of the Upper Big Branch mine, thereby resulting in the explosion of methane and other explosive gases.
When Senator Robert Byrd died in office earlier this year, Governor Joe Manchin appointed a placeholder and announced that he would run for the seat in the special election later this year. And when you announced that you were running against him, you said you weren't running to win, but just to raise the issue of mountaintop removal mining. Are you actively campaigning?
Yes. For example, yesterday I was down at the Mercer County Fair in Bluefield, West Virginia, which is the southernmost county of West Virginia. I got a tremendously positive reaction from everybody I talked with. After I finish this interview this evening, I'm going over to what is known as the Melta Fest, which is a black-supported community celebration with lots of music. And last night I was there until 10:30 p.m. and got a tremendously positive reaction. In fact, I'm getting a overwhelmingly positive reaction from everybody I run into, and I'm not just sitting in my office trying to make phone calls. I'm going out all around the 55 counties of the state, and my schedule is pretty well packed between now and the 28th of August when the primary election occurs.
What if you win?
Well, I must say that even though I started not expecting to win, now I'm emphasizing the fact that I will fight to win.
So you may be going back to Congress.
Even though I'm 3 years older than Senator Byrd, nevertheless, I think you can tell that although I may have a body of 95 years old, I have the mind, the heart, the passion, and the vigor of a 35-year-old.
That was Ken Heckler, who's running in the Democratic primary August 28th to be the party's candidate in the November 2nd special election to replace the late U.S. Senator Robert C. Byrd. For more information on the campaign, visit his website, kenhecklerforwestvirginia.org.
Is your SUV running low on gas? Is your wallet been running on fumes lately? Well, this is Behind Pollution, offering blowout prices on regular, plus, and premium at every BP Behind Pollution gas station, where you can get a gusher of savings filling up that Ford Excursion or that Hummer. And never mind our blown-out oil well at Macondo in the Gulf of Mexico. Never mind all those oiled pelicans. And never mind this burning hot summer of global warming. Never mind the voices that tell you to boycott BP for the horrific things Behind Pollution has done in the Gulf of Mexico. Just keep filling up that SUV. Just keep enjoying that gusher of savings the blowout prices at BP gas stations are bringing you. After all, you never liked seafood much anyway.